Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract fine print, or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
An October morning in a quiet suburb in a town in Scotland. A man is walking his dog when suddenly shots are fired from a car. The man falls to the ground and the car speeds off. An ordinary residential area, but extraordinary things happen in ordinary places.
The instinct right away was it was a political thing.
We're talking about Russian-trained, high-ranking officer in the Secret Service.
An Assassin Comes to Town, a six-part podcast. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm maybe a natural journalist because I'm a really dyed-in-the-wool skeptic. Yeah. I've got to prove it to myself.
Hello, everyone. Today we have a very interesting guest. Florence Fabricant, also known as Flo Fab, is the longest-running writer in the New York Times food section. She is the longest-running amongst the talented team of food writers at the New York Times. Her weekly columns, Front Burner and Off the Menu, explore the new and interesting in the culinary world. She also writes the Pairings column that appears alongside the wine reviews. She's authored 13 cookbooks. Her most recent work is the Ladies Village Improvement Society's 125th Anniversary Cookbook. Florence and I have both wined and dined and tasted and explored around the world. And we're here today to talk about the best of it. Welcome to my podcast, Florence. It's so nice to see you.
It's wonderful to see you, Martha.
So nice. And we've talked like this a couple of times in our careers.
We certainly have.
And I certainly have known you for a very, very long time.
Very long time.
You started at the New York Times at what year?
1972.
Oh, 72. And then in 1982, I wrote my first book when I sort of came into the culinary world. And I wonder what year we first met.
1977.
Okay.
Well, that was in Westport.
What was I doing? Catering?
Catering, yes. In a store.
At my little store.
Right. Oh. We had friends in Reading who gave me a heads up about it.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, how nice. Yeah. And there she is, the intrepid reporter coming out from New York to Westport, Connecticut. But that wasn't so far. And Westport was like the hotbed at that time of all kinds of great things. Paul Newman was our neighbor. And Robert Redford would come and visit. And we had an awfully, awfully good time there in Westport, Connecticut. And that's where I really started my catering business and then started writing books.
Right.
When I started entering the Florence Fabricant world. But we also have our East Hampton
connection.
Yep. I had my house on Lily Pond Lane, and I was an avid supporter of the Ladies Village Improvement Society. And you edited that beautiful cookbook, authored and edited,
right.
The beautiful cookbook. It's a lovely compilation of favorite recipes from, ladies, chefs, and other people who
and
live.
And celebrities.
Yeah, celebrities.
The difference between that one, I mean, until that book, more or less, there was another one before, but it was kind of drab. But until that book, it was the first sort of real color photograph professional cookbook. Prior to that, they were these spiral-bound jobs that had been done starting in sometime 100 years ago.
Well, that was tradition for all these ladies' clubs to have that spiral-bound. I have many of those from all kinds of towns.
So do I.
And I love them. Every now and then you find a recipe that becomes part of your repertoire, And I just love them so much. And I wrote the foreword. Heather Kirkland, who is my producer on this podcast, look at this giant pile of papers about you, Florence. She included my foreword to that book. And it makes me miss East Hampton. I sold my house 2 years ago, and I kind of miss Lily Pond Lane and the elm trees and the beauty of that town, because the Ladies Village Improvement Society, of which you've supported that society for so long, the village ladies do protect those elm trees. They really kept the beauty of that town and protected all the important buildings.
I think one of the reasons it was founded was because they decided that the village needed sidewalks.
Yeah.
And they were the ones that pushed that campaign.
And at the same time, put those sidewalks over the roots of the elm trees and didn't hurt the elm trees, because they are still alive and well, towering over those beautiful shady streets. And I love that town. It is, of all the Hamptons, I think the most beautiful Hampton.
Yeah.
Don't
it's
you?
Also in many ways the most diverse in terms of the culture and the art scene and so forth.
Yeah. And Florence lives not far from where I lived. But what did you learn about food out in the Hamptons?
I learned really the difference between fresh picked and grocery store, fresh picked and supermarket.
Because of all the farm stands?
Yeah. Well, that's why I started writing about food. It would drive me crazy to see people buying these supermarket tomatoes that were pale pink in July when their neighbor probably had a pile of freshly picked from their garden on a car table in their front yard in a jar for the money.
Right.
And it really was something that would, I felt I needed a megaphone. Because
so that's really, really what started you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. I decided, I mean, I was, it's complicated, but you know.
Well, Florence had a very good education. She went to Smith College, Phi Beta Kappa. You have garnered many, many honors in the culinary world, which are very impressive. But to find out that your love of food and your intent to write about food came from that is very interesting and very telling.
I mean, I grew up in a household with parents who were foodies at a time when they were not. And my mother was a superb cook. In fact, a year ago, Mother's Day, I did a story about her and her recipes and what I learned from her.
What was your favorite recipe?
Well, it was a recipe for lamb shanks that she got from a restaurant that no longer exists. I think it was in the East 30s, called Balkan Armenian.
Balkan Armenian. I ate there. Yeah. I loved Armenian food. Oh, my gosh.
With green peppers and red peppers and onions. And
oh, nice.
Yeah. Well, the way I wrote the story was I said, every time I slice onions, I think of my mother. And it's not because she makes me cry. It's because she sauteed onions so carefully. And that's I learned that from her.
Well, I think a lot of what you wrote about the freshness of food and the importance of using fresh ingredients, not just supermarket ingredients, really encourage a lot of people to start their backyard gardens also.
Well, you're much more of a gardener than I ever was.
I'm a serious, serious vegetable gardener now. And I am harvesting today. You would be so happy to see my celeriac. I grew celeriacs this big this year and pure white inside. They are so beautiful. I've never had celeriac like that before. Not that large and not that sweet. So your love of food comes from travel? From what? You've traveled so much and you are fluent in French. You studied, did you spend your junior year in France?
Yeah.
Oh, lucky.
And then
you.
I have a graduate degree in French. No, my love of food, I grew up with it. I can remember being very young, 4 or 5 years old, and we'd go to a Chinese restaurant. And it was very important to me to get the amount of soy sauce that I put in my egg drop soup just right. It had to be the right color. And I worked at it.
Oh, nice.
And I can remember that as being a very young child. I can remember hating a kind of pudding called junket. I hated it.
Oh, junket. I actually liked junket. That came out of a package.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was, I kind of liked it because we were not allowed very much sugar in our family. So every now and then, if we had something like the chocolate pudding out of a box or a junket, it was kind of a treat. But I agree with you. Right now, I couldn't eat that if you spoon-fed
me.
And
I remember the first time I ever had pecan pie. I think it was at a White Turkey in Midtown Manhattan. And I was fascinated when, I guess it was the waiter or the chef, because I wanted to know how it was made. I probably was 10 years old or some, and how you start with all of the nuts and the filling mixed together, but the nuts rise to the top and make their own crust, so to speak. I thought that I had to go home and make one because I couldn't believe that that's how it happened.
Besides your parents, who really influenced the way you thought about food?
I had an aunt who was more like a grandmother to me, my mother's oldest sister, who was also a very good cook. Later on, I devoured what I could read in the New York Times and Gourmet magazine. And then my parents, we would go to the top restaurants. We lived in Westchester, but we'd go to the theater. And beforehand, the routine was to go have dinner at the Algonquin. And I remember they did a chicken under glass. I remember the first time I ate sweetbreads there. I mean, these are all very vivid memories.
I loved going to the Algonquin. That was really quite a treat. What about Le Vaudor? Do you remember that?
I do.
Oh, and
I
did
do.
You go there for, yeah. for escargot?
Yeah.
I remember taking my very young daughter in the late 1968 or 9 or something, and she loved escargot even as a very young child. Where else did you eat?
I can remember my father taking me to Chambord, and they had all the different size champagne bottles in the window.
Oh, such a beautiful place.
And I wouldn't go into the restaurant until he gave me the names of all those, you know, the Nebuchadnezzar and the Jeroboam and the Balthazar forth.
Those are so beautiful.
That was a ritual.
And then the kitchen there, do you remember the kitchen was open to the seating area?
Yeah.
To the restaurant with those copper pots and pans hanging. I loved that restaurant.
Yeah. My father would take me to Dominic's on Arthur Avenue because my mother hated it.
Oh.
He would haul me up. Down there.
My father would take me to Chinatown and we would eat Chinese food or to Houston Street so we could go to Russ and Daughters and those places.
I remember going to Luchow's.
Oh, yes. Remember Luchow's. Oh, my gosh.
And Ruben's for apple pancakes on 58th Street after the theater.
So you began writing about food for the East Hampton Star in 1972. Why did you start there?
Well, as I say, I thought I needed a megaphone I had friends I was the one they always asked, who's got the best potato salad?
Were you married then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, you were married. Okay. Yeah. What year did you get married?
1960.
Oh, I got 61. I got married. Florence is still married to her same husband.
Same husband.
And I am not. And your daughter actually designs some of your books.
She designed the LVIS book.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh.
And we've done 6 cookbooks together.
How great. So she's a graphic designer.
Yeah.
What newspapers in 1972 were looking for a food writer?
Well, the East Hampton Star wasn't looking for a food writer, and it never occurred to me to be a food writer as a full-time career. I was debating whether to go to law school. And, I was out of college. I had worked in market research and advertising straight out of college because it was the only job I could get that didn't require me to be a secretary. I tried to find something using my French and couldn't. And I stopped working to be a full-time mom when my daughter was born. And I wanted to go back to work because 72, both kids would be in school full-time. And looked into various and sundry. And in the meantime, I'm in East Hampton over the summer and people are buying iceberg lettuce in the supermarket and it's making me crazy. So, so I suggested to Everett Rattray, the editor of The Star, a food column.
This is the East Hampton Star, which is such a charming newspaper. So what did he say?
He said, write a sample. Uh-huh. And I said, how many words? And he said, 400. And it took me 2 weeks.
What was it? What was the first column?
Tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
But I have to say, you know, today I could write that column in the shower.
of course. Well, you get practice makes perfect.
And I said to myself, if he agrees to pay me, I'll do it. And I started doing it, and within 6 months, I was getting assignments from the Times, and there you have it.
So they found you there.
Yeah.
And you've been writing for the Times ever since.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic career. And very few people stay at such a job for that long and amass such a wide audience, because you have a very wide audience. You have made a tremendous mark in the world of food.
Well, and there's chefs, no better platform.
And chefs love you.
There's no better platform, in my view, than the New York Times. End of story. I could possibly be a blogger today and make a ton of money, but it's not where my head is.
Yeah, I agree. I read that. That's the first thing I do in the morning when I wake up, when I woke up and I read the New York Times cover to cover on my iPad. And today is Wednesday, food, although the food articles come out online like the day before or the day before that.
Yeah, actually, the non-alcoholic wine story was first published online, I think, Thursday. The thing about the Times is, number one, it's owned by people who believe in journalism, number one. And number two, there is integrity. And I appreciate that.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and I want to let you know about my new immersive BBC Radio 4 podcast series, Deep Calm. It's all about how to tap into and activate a remarkable system that we all have hardwired inside of us, our relaxation response. And it's been developed to be listened to at any time you want to really unwind. I hope you'll listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dad deserves something really nice for Father's Day, but let's face it, we usually don't do it. Big gifts are for Mother's Day. Picking something up on the way is for Father's Day. Well, let's make Father's Day something this year with the Bartesian Cocktail Maker. It whips up over 60 premium cocktails on demand, each ready at the push of a button. And right now, you get $50 off the Bartesian Cocktail Maker when you buy one pack of Dad's favorite cocktail capsules. Dad will publicly love that you saved $50 on the countertop machine that crafts premium cocktails on demand, and he'll secretly love that you splurged on him for Father's Day with the gift of a Bartesian. Because the only thing that lets Dad know he's the world's number one dad better than a world's number one dad coffee mug is an artisan cocktail in his hand. Make Dad's Father's Day and Father's Day cocktails with all natural juices and bitters without making any mess at all. Visit bartesian.com/father to get $50 off the best premium cocktail maker for Dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Who was at the food section when you started there in 1980?
Well, Jean Hewitt was there.
Oh, I love Jean Hewitt.
Mimi?
Oh, Mimi Sheraton.
Marion Burroughs.
Marion Burroughs.
Moira Hodgson. Frank Pryl.
Every name very, very familiar to those of us who really did read the New York Times.
Yeah.
Whose restaurant reviews did you like the best?
That's an interesting question. I would say maybe Craig.
Oh, remember? Oh, I love
Craig. He was there when I was there. Yeah. Because he kind of set a standard. And what I so admire about him is that the restaurant reviews were not about him.
That's right. They were about the food.
He wanted to communicate with an audience, and his opinions were important, and he believed what he believed, but it was not, he was never a grandstand show off.
You're right.
And that was...
And so you got to know him.
Yes.
I did too. Well. I did too out in the Hamptons.
Yeah.
It was so exciting to get to know Craig Claiborne, whose books I loved and whose own recipes I liked so much too.
Yeah.
I remember going to one party with him and James Beard. So extraordinary. What are some of the stories that help you build your presence in the New York Times? Do you remember the different stories?
I'll give you a really, to me, kind of a benchmark. I got an assignment from the magazine, it was in the mid-80s, to write about one restaurant west of the Mississippi. One restaurant. Brian Miller was going to write about one restaurant east of the Mississippi, and he opted to write about the Rhinebeck Inn. I forget who was the chef there at the time. It was somebody pretty famous. I started to think about it. And a few months previously, I had visited for the first time, and it was fairly new at that time. It was quite new, Matsuhisa in Los Angeles.
Oh, my favorite.
And I had never been. I had had Japanese food. Sushi was beginning to show up. And I had never seen a restaurant with a 30-page menu. And I thought the food was amazing. The squid pasta, for example, and the rock shrimp tempura and the black cod. I mean, his landmark recipe dishes that he still produces, and so does everybody else in the world.
Of Japanese.
So that's what I wrote about.
Oh, I'd like to read that.
And I never heard from him until he opened.
From Nobu? You did not hear?
He did. I did this, not
Matsuhisa
hear from him.
This Matsuhisa is the formal name of Nobu, the great chef Nobu Matsuhisa.
And his first restaurant was Matsuhisa.
Yes, it was.
On La Cienega.
Yep, and it's still there.
And it wasn't a pretty restaurant. It was very, very simple.
Sort of in a strip. Mm-hmm. It's enlarged greatly, and they had that huge parking lot on the side. And during COVID, they covered that over, and people ate outside. Yeah.
Well, fast forward to opening Nobu in Manhattan, and Robert De Niro and Drew and so forth. And Nobu was there. And when he met me, he said, "You know, I never thanked you for writing about Matsuhisa." I said, "That's okay."
I must say, I am a big fan of Nobu and what he's done for Japanese cuisine in America, bringing it from Japan to Peru and then to New York. I had a wonderful, wonderful book launch party there, I think for my weddings book. And he was charming. If there's a Nobu, I go and visit. I was in, Saudi Arabia, and I went to a Nobu.
Wow.
He's all over the place.
Yes, he
is. All
over
the place.
They're opening a Nobu hotel on the Upper East Side.
And they're beautiful hotels. Yeah. Really beautifully tasteful. Now, how is the food editorial team organized these days? There seem to be a lot of new names.
Tons.
And lots of new.
I mean, the department is now more than 100 people.
Oh, really? That
with
big?
With an off-premises test kitchen and everything else.
And so many new recipes every single day, feeding that insatiable desire for easy, for fast, for one pot. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going
on. Sheet pan.
Yep, sheet pan cooking. Yeah, all of that. Yeah. So it's 100 people now. That's huge.
Yeah, a lot of it devoted to video because video and photographs and all of that is what drives eyeballs to the website.
Yes, it does.
It's very important.
In your New York Times column, Front Burner, you review new foods, food stores, cooking products. What do you look for in products and places that you select?
Well, the column has evolved over the years, and the mandate for the past several years has been new products, new stores, new people, new events, and so forth, which is extremely helpful for me because it helps me narrow down what I'm writing about, because otherwise I'd go nuts.
How many objects do you get a week to review?
Well,
you must get a lot.
I only get what I want.
Okay.
They
send it to the Times? People send their things to
people do send stuff, but I've tried to limit that down to almost zero because I don't want stuff that I haven't requested and I'm not interested in.
Oh, I see. So what are three products in 2023 that you would highly recommend to someone like me or anybody, any reader?
Well, the line of, there are a million chili crisps now and I get a new chili crisp pitch like every single day. No, thank you. But the line by this company, Fly By Jing,
I haven't seen that.
I like what she does.
Okay.
And she just came out with a chili crisp that's different because it has pumpkin seeds and things like that. So it's crunchier. And I really like that.
Oh, okay. And then what else?
I got samples of these baked goods from Alexis Gamblin, who's French. And he just started this company, Chez Tonton. And he does a very interesting take on a pecan pie, which is not a filling in a crust, but it's more like a shortbread crust. It's a very short pastry with the pecan filling running through it, and then the top surface have glazed pecans all over it. And then he does little cookie versions of those.
That sounds good.
He calls them little cakes. And I think that those are kind of great.
And the third?
Well, that turnip, Macomber turnip from upstate, that originated in Massachusetts.
White? Is that a white turnip?
It's a white turnip, and it's very big, and it's sweet.
I just picked all of mine.
And it's kind of a rarity.
Oh, they're so beautiful. They are as big as, like, softballs.
Mm-hmm.
I have a new raised bed garden, so everything this year grew incredibly well and blemish-free, which is very nice.
That's
when
nice.
When a turnip comes up, pure white and no blemishes, you know you're doing something right.
Absolutely.
Those are very nice finds. So if you want to know the latest and the best, read the Wednesday edition of the New York Times, Florence Fabricant. So how has your audience changed, or has it, when the Times moved much of the food content behind a paywall? Because now, you know, you go to find a recipe and it's you have to join the New York Times.
Well, there are two kinds of paywalls. There's the paywall for subscribers.
Yes.
Who,
which is expensive. The subscription to the Times online is very expensive.
The cooking website, cooking.nytimes.com,
right,
if you're not a subscriber, is a separate paywall.
Right.
And you could subscribe just to that.
Yes. And then you would
miss. I think it's been successful. I mean,
Oh, it must be if you have 100 employees working in there now.
The digital keep subscribing. The numbers keep going up and up and up. And the other thing, the other discovery, if you want to talk about discoveries, is I've been following this non-alcoholic wine scene.
Yes, I was just going to ask you about that.
I had a big story recommending whites and reds for Thanksgiving. And the whites, the best ones in the beginning were the sparklers. Mm-hmm. Sparklers, because the carbonation sort of compensates very nicely for the lack of alcohol. But the whites have been getting better and better, and now the reds are coming along. I think they need work still. There are a couple that have appealed to me. Beers are amazing. And what shocks me is that more restaurants are not putting them on their list. They have them by the glass. Let people buy a bottle. The nice thing about non-alcoholic wine, forgetting everything else, is you can enjoy it at lunch, regardless of your attitude.
Exactly. But it's the best variety. Can you make some suggestions for non-alcoholic?
Well, I tend to prefer varietals. There are companies that do non-alcoholic wines that are concoctions
blends
with tea and not using wine as the base that try and mimic wine. And I haven't found much that appeals to me.
So how is a non-alcoholic wine made?
Well, there are several methods. One is they can use a centrifuge. They can use reverse osmosis. There are different techniques that are used
to get the alcohol out.
To take the alcohol out. Now, I have found Sauvignon Blanc to be quite reliable because it has good acidity, good minerality. And across the boards, Sauvignon Blancs I've tasted done pretty well. On the red side, and also Riesling. Riesling, there's something called Grüner Weiss, which is a blend of Grüner Veltliner, and it also holds up. On the red side, they're just beginning to figure it out. Okay. Most of the reds are a little flat, a little sweet. They don't have that complexity and the tannins you expect in a red wine. But I've got a couple that I haven't opened that I'm waiting to try.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all 6 delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
This is the story of one of fashion's dark secrets.
I was overwhelmed. Like, I had never seen anything like this.
At the height of Abercrombie & Fitch's success.
This was me being carefully manipulated.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Investigating allegations that would take me into a world of money, sex, and power. This is World of Secrets, Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Father's Day is coming, a day we celebrate the guy who's always there for us, to crack a dad joke. Well, you know what's not a dad joke? Getting $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker with the purchase of his favorite cocktail capsule pack. $50 off. No dad joke. See, this is a dad joke. I lost my glasses today, and guess who I bumped into? Everyone. But the Bartesian cocktail maker, it's no joke. Each cocktail capsule contains real fruit juices and all natural bitters, so Dad can make over 60 premium cocktails he loves. Sidecars, old fashions, gimlets, all with the push of a button. So, for the dad who loves a cocktail with friends and a good joke from time to time, get the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. $50 off now until Father's Day. Visit bartesian.com/father to get 50 off the best premium cocktail maker for dad at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
So what do you see happening in food right now that you find so exciting?
Well, more and more of paying attention to the environment, paying attention to seasonality in a very honest way, instead of just saying it's all farm to table and then serving raspberries in December. Come on, doing their homework, when chefs do their homework when they go shopping. And I think it's increasingly important. And, you know, carbon footprint and all of that figures into it, but you cannot take away from the need to keep things local, as little industrialized as possible. Wheat has changed so much.
So much.
So much, and it's not good for you. And it drives me crazy that restaurants are serving Parker House rolls. You know, I look for whole grains all the time now. But I think that there is more and more attention paid to that aspect. And I think that that's a good thing. More vegetable friendly menus across the boards as well.
So what do you think of 11 Madison Park?
Well, I think what he's doing is commendable. I don't love everything he's doing. I'm sure you probably feel the same way, but it's certainly very interesting. You know, Cafe Chelsea in the Chelsea Hotel?
Yes.
They have a main course, maitake mushroom au poivre, that is so delicious, and it's so big you can't, I couldn't finish it, but it's just delicious, and it's a main course. And I think the more you see of that, the better.
Yeah, the eating less meat, of course, maybe more fish, but maybe more vegetables.
Yeah.
And the vegan craze is quite astonishing to me, that people are trying it.
Yeah.
I just had a young woman on my show on TV the other day who made a smoothie. She thinks, she really, really believes that her smoothie in the morning will compensate for her not eating pretty much the rest of the day. And it's like oatmeal and not too much fresh stuff, but purple potatoes and all kinds of additives, which I don't think take the place of a fabulous green vegetable.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I think, you know, these vegetable pills in a bottle, I don't believe in that at all. I believe in real food. And I think that there are elements in real food that you get that you cannot reproduce by taking a pill or that kind of thing.
Right. And in 1984, notwithstanding, I think we have a long way to go before we're going to be just eating pills or drinking just weird smoothies.
Right.
I don't want that to happen. Not in my lifetime. Of the changes that you've seen over the years in food, what really surprised you?
What surprised me, I think most recently over the past, let's say, decade or so, is how fast stuff catches on. And I think a lot of that has to do with social. I think sort of a watershed moment might have been back in the late 80s when restaurants started serving radicchio and arugula and using balsamic vinegar. And suddenly everybody wanted to buy those things. I mean, in the past, if you ate something in a restaurant, I can remember growing up, you weren't interested or going to try and reproduce that restaurant dish at home, unless you were my mother. That's another story. But most people didn't. And now I think the availability of arugula and radicchio and some of these other ingredients, that the availability and the ease with which people can buy and use garlic. When I was growing up, there wasn't a hell of a lot of garlic around.
Oh, and I have like 18 varieties of garlic in my garden, and they all are different. And they are all delicious, cooked different ways.
And then I think about something like what Dan Barber's doing with these new vegetables, the garlic. Have you tried that?
Oh, I just had a dinner with Dan where he served garlics, which is a cross between a leek and a garlic. It was delicious.
Yes.
He just braised them very simply.
Yeah.
And they were delicious. And he's working with a group that is called the New Organic Project.
Right, right.
They are trying to verify what is organic and what is not organic. Organic is just a word now in the supermarkets. It's slapped on.
When I see people selling organic salmon, I say, what?
What is that? Right.
Yeah. How could that
yeah,
be?
But in the vegetable department especially,
yeah.
we don't know that it's organic or not. In order to age gracefully, stay healthier, we can't fill the hospitals with ailing people. We have to know what we can eat that's going to keep us really going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The one thing about the LVIS cookbook, I don't know if you're aware of, is that it is a salmon-free cookbook.
Salmon-free.
Yeah. Well,
I did not know about that. I didn't know
salmon
that was...
doesn't belong in East Hampton.
Yeah, they can't be fished there. They cannot be. But you do have something that I see the signs, and I went to that little place on the way to Amagansett where it says clam pies on a sign nailed to a tree. What the heck is a clam pie?
Oh, it's delicious. There's my recipe in the book.
Oh, that's yours.
Clam
oh, okay.
pie goes way back. I mean, if you go back to the spiral-bound LVIS cookbooks from the 1940s, say, you'll find clam pie. It's a two-crust pie, and the filling is chopped up clams, usually onions and potatoes and whatever clam juices, as a pie filling.
Oh, so it's like a stuffed clam in a crust.
Well, it's not as finely
minced.
There's no bread or anything,
okay.
and it's not as finely minced
oh, okay.
as... It's almost more like a clam pizza topping without the cheese.
Oh, okay.
In a crust. And in fact, I've used a clam pie. Sometimes it has bacon. I've also used that filling mixture to make quesadillas as hors d'oeuvres.
Oh, I bet that's good.
It's delicious.
I bet that's good. But clams now are like $2 each for a little clam. Do you have a special little clam spot in East Hampton where you go dig your own?
I don't dig. I buy them. But I open them. I think clams are easier to open than oysters.
Oh, I have a clam knife now, an oyster knife, and a scallop knife.
Oh.
Because they are growing scallops in Maine in the ocean on long ropes mm-hmm. hanging down into the sea. And they are delicious. And you can really enjoy them raw. You can have them as crudo so nicely. Oh, it's so good. Well, you've hosted a speaking series, I don't want to mention this, at Guildhall.
Right.
Where you are on the board. Do you have any favorite moments of those events?
Well, with you.
Oh, yes. Well, that was so fun. And it was a sellout crowd, and we had a really nice time.
Yeah, and you brought this amazing cornucopia of vegetables and flowers from your garden. It was, but I'll tell you, the very best was Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, well, he was always the best.
He was outrageous, funny. Just amazing. And people were hanging from the rafters to hear him speak.
Wow.
He was unforgettable.
So 6 of your books were designed by your daughter, 13 books to date. What do you like about working with your daughter?
We get along. We've got a very good relationship. Yeah.
And how do you stay curious? Because you're very curious.
Well, I've always been curious. I've always said that if I'm no longer learning something, I'm going to stop. But you talked it like this turnip. I've got background on it. Or somebody is doing something unusual and I learn about it. I'm always learning. I'm always researching. Somehow I'm going to be writing about Mark Polanski's Onion book.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated with a lot of what he had to say.
I bet. I haven't seen it.
One of the things I've said, I was reading it and coincidentally, it reminded me of Thanksgiving because when I was growing up, there were always creamed onions on the Thanksgiving menu. And he has a whole chapter
on
creamed onions.
Oh, wow.
Of all things. Oh, yeah.
I haven't made creamed onions for a very long time.
Maybe. Yeah, he says they're out of fashion.
And what's your advice to young food writers or these youngins who want to write a cookbook? What's your advice?
Do homework. Don't just accept what people tell you. Look it up. Go back and do your homework. It just shocks me how accepting people are of certain things that are just not true or accurate and that they don't do diligence in terms of getting information. If their publicist's working for a client, they accept what the client says whole cloth without ever asking a question. I mean, I can't tell you how often I've said to a publicist who is pitching a product, let's say a condiment, and I'll say, have you tasted it? No. Or a gadget? Have you tried it? No. Or you can use such and such website. Have you gone to the website to see if it works? No. I mean, how can you do anything without digging? I'm maybe a natural journalist because I'm a really dyed-in-the-wool skeptic. And I gotta prove it. Yeah. I gotta prove it to myself.
Well, you're great, and your columns show it. Thank you so much for sitting down with me. You can find Florence's writing in the New York Times each week, and you can follow her on X at FloFab, FLOFAB.
Thank you, Martha. This is a pleasure.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and I want to let you know about my new immersive BBC Radio 4 podcast series, Deep Calm. It's all about how to tap into and activate a remarkable system that we all have hardwired inside of us. Our relaxation response. And it's been developed to be listened to at any time you want to really unwind. I hope you'll listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.